Yeah, so thank you very much for organizing this really wonderful conference. I mean, I really waited for a conference bringing architecture and history of science and medicine together. So I'm very happy to be here. And today I'm going to talk about two anatomical theaters in London. And so I will talk in German, but you can also ask me in Italian if you would like. Sorry, yeah, I'm going to speak in English. Sorry. I already said that I'm kind of lost in translation. No, I don't want to, because I want you to understand me. So I'm going to talk in English now. Thank you. Okay, so in the course of the 17th century, two anatomical theatres were established in London for the performance of public anatomies. For the first theatre in 1636, the Barber Surgeons Company commissioned the Renaissance architect Inigo Jones, who was known for his courtly stage designs as well as for his public buildings. The mathematician Robert Hooke, who was the curator of experiments at the Royal Society and among the founders of an empirical science, oversaw the construction of a second theatre for the Royal College of Physicians from 1679. So I just brought both of them. The first theatre can be characterized as emblematic of Renaissance culture, based on an analogous understanding of the world and linked to practices of veiling and unveiling. By contrast, the second theatre is seen to open a new path to a rational and anti-illusionistic way of perceiving nature and the role of humans within nature. Several historical developments suggest that the approach to representation adopted in the two theatres differed considerably. Between the construction of the first and the second building, the English Civil War took place, which ended the monopoly of the Church of England in matters of faith and led to a short period of parliamentary rule that was followed by the restoration of the monarchy. The loss of political and religious unity and the fragmentation of English society were accompanied by a fragmented view of the human body. After 1628, the discovery of the circulatory system by the English physician and anatomist William Harvey called into question the doctrine of the foeumus, which had held sway since antiquity as the basis of the entire system of thought. In the spirit of René Descartes, the single parts or functions of the body came to be seen in isolation, and inductive reasoning gained prevalence. While both buildings as a type find their reference in the anatomical theatre of Padua and or Leiden, their epistemological reference points seems to diverge. If Jones' theatre is read as an allegory, Hooke's theatre is seen as an instrument. In my lecture, I would like to explore the question to what extent such distinction is accurate, to what extent it is shaped by discourses and functionality in the 19th and 20th century. In contrast to the first anatomical theatres on the continent, the first anatomical theatre in England was not erected by a university, but by the city company of the barber surgeons, who traditionally competed with the Academic College of Physicians for royal privileges and dominance within the medical field. Instead of creating a new space within an existing building, the surgeons commissioned a separate oval-shaped building that embodied the company's conception of the world and their place within. As well as playing a role as a royal guild charged with training the king's surgeons for the Royal Navy, the company members sought to advance a scientific understanding of the world. By combining theory with manual skills, the surgeons sought to rival academically trained physicians and they claimed to have the knowledge needed to reveal the divine order of nature. Thus, both the political and the intellectual spheres influenced the form of representation that was expressed in the anatomical theater of the royal surgeons. So you see a picture now. Later on, I will explain a little bit the different zones. While many other guilds, and particularly the religious ones, had been dissolved during the Reformation, and their property had been confiscated, Henry VIII allowed the surgeons to merge with the barbers in 1540 to form a joint trade company. This strengthened their status within the city guild system, which safeguarded the social, political, and religious order. The company was also granted the right to receive for its public anatomies 4 bodies a year, chosen among the criminals who had been publicly hanged. Executions and dissections thus became 2 acts in a single drama, charged with both legal and spiritual connotations. Spectacles of public punishment were both demonstrations of power and quasi-religious festivals. These events were regarded as an act of restoration in a world disrupted by crime. Similar in their cathartic character to public punishment, the spectators of anatomies were involved in a universal healing process and fostered a recognition of one's mortality and a moral reflection on a godly life. Similarly to the Anatomical Theatre of Leiden, the Barber's Auditorium in London was adorned with skeletons and human skins as memento mori symbols. And a bust of King Charles I was erected in 1641, when the king was still the head of the society chosen by God, with the aim to draw the attention of the audience to the royal principles of justice that brought the bodies into the theater. There was a hierarchy within the company, as there was among the city guilds, and that hierarchy was reflected in the arrangement of the audience for anatomical dissections. Inigo Jones' experience in designing theatres is apparent in his design in the sophisticated sequence of arrivals established for the audience and the dissector, and in the organization of concentric seating. The lower 2 levels provided seating for the members of the company's court, the livery, and important visitors, and was reached through the main entrance at first floor level, from the hall across the gallery and through the central door. So you see here these first rows where the most important people were sitting, and they were able to arrive there from this gallery from the first floor that was connected to the livery hall. So this entrance on the first floor level. The common freemen, the apprentices, and members of the public stood on the higher 3 tiers. A stair tower on each side of the main entrance, each with a narrow wooden door, gave direct access to the upper tier from outside. So they entered here and came over here and had the possibility to stand in these ranks. The balustrade prevented the occupants of the upper and lower tiers from mixing, which is similar to the division used in Jones' design of the cockpit theater. The performance and the clothing of the surgeons recalled the state visits and other public ceremonies in which the company took part and served to heighten the dramatic and spectacular nature of the event. In order to signal the company's intellectual ambitions, Jones and the surgeons developed a complex spatial and artistic system of microcosm and macrocosm, which represented the conditions and possibilities of absolute cognition through the human senses. As important role, fell to the writings of the physicians and intellectuals Helkaya Krug and, we already heard about him, Robert Flatt, who were associated with the guild and presumably influenced the theater's shape. Under the influence of Neoplatonism, Krug and Flatt divided the structure of the body and the structure of the world into three correspondent realms. In his book Mikrokosmographia, 1615, which he dedicated to the Barber Surgeons Company, Krug stated that the liver, kidney, and genitals corresponded to the sublunary world, the chest and the heart to the celestial world, and finally, the head and the seat as the seat of the soul to the heavenly or divine world. So you see these different realms here in the representation. Since anthropomorphism was anchored in the thinking of Renaissance architects, and that we already heard in the introduction, and Inigo Jones also referred to this idea and his notes on in his notes on Serlio, it is not excessive to connect the concepts promoted by Krug and Flatt with the design of the theatre. The private dissecting rooms, so they were here in the lower floor where the body was prepared for the public anatomy, but also for private dissections. So the private dissection rooms correspond to the sublunary world. The lecture theatre corresponds to the center of bodily and physical life. The intermediate zone is adorned with the figures of the seven liberal sciences as the means to gather true knowledge and to ascend to the painted dome as to heaven. So I'm sorry, we don't have a lot of pictures of this anatomical theater. So we have these two drawings. And I went there, but there is nothing left of the building. It's in the Barbican estate. So it's an interesting experience, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of sources. So we have these two sketches. Akin to the heavens depicted in contemporary public playhouses, such as The Fortune and Hope, the ceiling of the anatomical theater was painted with the stars, planets, and signs of the zodiac. In the tradition of memory theater, so it's good that we already heard something about memory theater, which was conceptualized by Giulio Camillo around 1550, the topical cosmos was contained in the inner room of the mind, where ideas and concepts were arranged in a spatial order. Robert Flatt, theosophist and physician who joined the London Barber Surgeons Company in 1634, also attempted to locate the physiological areas of perception and knowledge production within the human head. He imagined the inner world of the mind as a theatrical space and the human body and mind as being a stage of the cosmos. Drawing on the scholastic theory of the three cerebral ventricles, which are supposed to lead from the sensory observation to rational selection and then to storage in the memory, Flatt addressed the question of whether true knowledge could be attained through the human senses. According to Flatt, the mundus sensibilis can be thought of as a rectangular theater, we already heard of it, on whose stage of the microcosm the five senses meet. Conversely, the memoria visionum can be thought of as a round amphitheater, the macrocosmic stage that is described as the theater of display and of battles. Here, the structure of the world was not only mirrored, but also reproduced. Thus, if one sees the anatomical theater of the Surgeons Guild from the perspective of Flatt, it represents the round amphitheater of ultimate truth, in which ideas and concepts struggle in the generative act of creation. In contrast to the theatrical mode of Jones' theater, the anatomical theater that Hooke designed for the College of Physicians in 1676 has been interpreted as a technical tool that represented the world without any illusionary effect or any idealization. When James Elms defined the theater in 1823 as a perfect study of acoustical and optical architecture, he expressed the 19th century ideal of a perfect scientific building. But was it possible to escape the paradigm of theatrical representation by building a kind of seeing machine? A group of senior physicians who were also founding members of the Royal Society entrusted Hooke with the reconstruction of the College House and its anatomical theatre after the Great Fire of London in 1666. Hooke was a polymath who argued for experimental philosophy based on observation. In 1665, he published his carefully illustrated book, Micrographia, a microscopic investigation on animal bodies based on what Janice Neri has called visual dissections. At first glance, Hooke seems to reject the modes of theatricality adopted in the surgeon's theater. In contrast to the philosophical concept embodied in the surgeon's theater as a representation of the Teatro Mundi, the architecture of Hooke's auditorium is evidently functional and appears entirely dictated by the need to maximize visibility. The Seventh Bay College building was arranged around a quadrangle with the anatomical theater located above the college gate. So here you see the quadrangle. This is the entrance, and the anatomical theater was erected above the gate. So here you see the inner court of the college, and you see the section of the anatomical theater. In its elevated position, it was exposed to sunlight, and the large conical lantern and the carefully placed oculi provided natural light in the rooms. Lisa Jardine has pointed out that Hooke's architectural and scientific works were closely linked, or if not to say, one and the same. He used physical knowledge gained from his experience to build instruments on a small scale and architectural design on a large scale. Thus, the lantern resembles in some respects, the scotoscope you see here, designed by Hooke, which was characterized by indirect incidence of light as not to distort the object depicted. So here you have the microscope that is working with the concept of indirect lighting. And if you look at this lantern here, you see that Hooke tried to use this technical invention also for the construction of the anatomical theatres to have a certain lightning that exposes the body in the center of the room. So what I'm doing now is switching from the archive, as Mrs. Klestinek said, so the technical body, to what happened inside. Because now my question is, what was the effect of this lighting? The lighting illuminated the open body in the center of the room, making it look isolated and separated from its real world context, so like a spot. As demanded by Hooke and his teacher, Robert Boyle, this staging evoked the sense of estrangement of the detached scientific gaze. As in the illustration of Hooke's Microscopia, which sought to create a realistic, if highly artificial, effect of direct observation, the body in the anatomical theater gave an illusion of the act of looking at the visible world. The illumination of the body in the anatomical theater can be read as a strategy of aestheticization that served to prove God's existence through the beauty of his works. As Alexander Ragamoli has shown, this kind of aestheticization sought to stimulate the affective dimensions of the scientific experience and to incorporate the philosopher's affective states into practices of scientific inquiry and representation. Pleasure should accompany the discovery of truth. Ragamoli has described how researchers have long assumed that natural philosophers used their methods to anesthetize the philosophical community against the pleasure of beauty and to combat the distortion of individual subjectivity. In the opinion of Hooke and his contemporaries, however, the exercise of reason depended on the careful management of feelings rather than on their exclusion from experimentation. Therefore, conscious sensory perception served the knowledge of God and bolstered the Royal Society's claims about the moral and political utility of natural philosophy. Instead of dividing the English nation along religious lines, natural philosophy should be acceptable to different religious parties as it provides evidence of the existence of God through rational arguments. The goal of employing and channeling effects connected natural philosophers beyond medical practices to classical theater, whose performance always served to visualize and internalize the appropriate effects. In this context, the anatomical theater of the College of Physicians was not merely an instrument of disinterested and functional research. Instead, like its counterpart, it made use of theatrical strategies to affirm the connection between natural philosophy and knowledge of God. As Stephen Chapin has shown long ago, Hooke and his fellow scientists argued that the validity of natural knowledge flowed from public presences at its making and public goods as its outcome, so quotation. Public presence was meant to guarantee that experimental knowledge was reliable and authentic. Given that the moral integrity of the audience members served to vouch for the reliability of the knowledge issuing from dissection, it was clear that the anatomical theater would not become obsolete as venue of scientific representation after the Baconian shift. In the case of both Jones' theater and Hooke's theater, the making of knowledge was profoundly social and required elaborate forms of representation. It was only when sensory pleasure and moral instruction were banished from the legitimate knowledge making that theatricality lost its function and came into conflict with scientific inquiry. Thank you.